Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio.
This week is Eating Disorder Awareness Week, a global initiative that looks at conditions that affect an estimated 200,000 people in Ireland. Ronan talked to Suzanne Horgan of eatingdisorders.ie and asked her, what is the difference between disordered eating and eating disorders?
Well, I suppose, yeah, we have to kind of separate it from where somebody's just kind of dieting per se. So it's where somebody exhibits unhealthy eating and weight control behaviours. So we're talking about somebody who's restricting, somebody who would be purging, or somebody who would be what we call binge eating, which would be eating a very large volume of food in a very short space of time. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the idea that on some level there's a medicating going on there of some sort.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, most people that will experience eating disorders, they have an inability to handle uncomfortable feelings or painful situations. So it is kind of a form of coping. It's a coping skill that people develop. Yeah.
Now, you know the way, a lot of people, including myself, would probably describe themselves as being emotional eaters. Is there a line somewhere in the middle there where it starts flipping into from disordered eating into eating disorders, or would you say actually look, it's all of a form of eating disorder really?
I think there is kind of a fine line whereby when it has an adverse effect on your life, that's when you can then start to kind of look at, okay, there's a problem here, because a lot of us will go and have that bar of chocolate or have that ice cream and just to feel a bit better, but if this is where somebody is constantly pushing down feelings that they find uncomfortable, and unfortunately feelings are like children, they need to be heard, they'll keep coming up, and then the person, because they don't like them, will keep pushing them down. So it is a little bit different to a kind of an ordinary person who may just kind of, as again, have that bar of chocolate or that ice cream.
So the person gets into a kind of a power struggle with their own feelings in a way.
Absolutely. You're getting into kind of an absolute power struggle with yourself almost. Yeah, and I always say that an eating disorder is synonymous with the relationship you have with yourself, with the relationship you have with food. They're synonymous, yeah.
Very interesting. Kind of taking a slightly wider view, would you be able to tell us about the situation in Ireland with regard to eating disorders? What are the statistics like?
Oh gosh, well, they reckon there's about 200,000 people in Ireland experiencing eating disorders, and they say there's about 1,800 new cases kind of every week.
1,800 every week?
Yeah. Now, personally, wow. I find the numbers in terms of 200,000, I think there's a bigger number, because you have a lot of people that don't even realise they're experiencing an eating disorder. And then you've kind of a lot of people that don't kind of come forward. And then for me, I find it heartbreaking that there's so many people in rural counties who don't have qualified, trained professionals around them, and they can go undiagnosed or they can go untreated. And as we all know, early interventions make a huge difference in terms of you coming out the other side. So that's why I always feel when we kind of banter these numbers, for me, I think the numbers are much higher.
So in a way, you have like 200,000 people presenting on some level.
Absolutely, yes, Ronan.
And who knows if that's a third or a quarter of the actual number.
Absolutely, and you have a lot of male sufferers, but because it's kind of particularly anorexia is deemed as a female problem, you've a lot of male sufferers who kind of go undiagnosed or who aren't actually aware that that's what they're doing, you know, and they could be going kind of into the gym kind of, you know, with body dysmorphia, and yet, you know, this is what's kind of, you know...
Absolutely. So I remember, I mean, 1,000 years ago when I was reading up on some of this stuff, somebody saying that they weren't sure, but they thought that the male sufferers could be something like 1 in 5. Is that right, or is it somewhere in there?
There was initially kind of a long, like when I started out back 20 years ago, there was probably 1 in 10, but now we're looking at kind of 2 in 10, which would be like your equivalent to 1 in 5. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. There is an increase for sure.
And those people are definitely not showing up to OA or whatever, are they? Really?
Absolutely. I think the males kind of, unfortunately, they suffer in silence, or they find it really hard to come forward as well. Kind of, you know, they can be stigmatized, or they genuinely don't realize that there's an actual kind of, you know, real issue going on possibly.
Do you see a change in numbers? I mean, you've been at it for a few years. Do you see a change in numbers in terms of obesity and overeating versus undereating? And I know you know there's issues around obesity anyway because of lack of exercise,
of course,
but in terms of your specific area,
I would find that there's definitely an increase in people presenting kind of with binge eating and overeating, higher than kind of the amounts that would present with anorexia.
Right.
Yes, interestingly enough. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a hunch about why that might be the case?
Gosh, you know, I think there's such a combination of kind of life being stressful, people needing to push food down, people then kind of literally getting so busy they're neglecting themselves, and then they'll grab something. Then it's usually a high fat, high sugar food to get the energy. That becomes a pattern. They don't have time to eat. And then before you know it, you're developing a weight problem, you're developing the patterns. And then it's a very hard cycle then to get out of unless you stop and reflect and do something about it.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, just as you were saying it there, like if you have a susceptibility, and you're in that kind of working too hard, not self-caring, not looking after yourself, and then you take a couple of foods that could be triggers for you, whammo, you're straight into a binge.
And absolutely, that can be, you know, and again, kind of, you know, to quantify a binge, it has to be a large volume of food in a short space of time. And to diagnose someone, they'd have to be kind of binge eating twice a week for over 3 months.
Right.
So it's kind of like there is a classification, a DSM classification on it, you know.
Okay.
But it is very easy to get sucked into that then because of life, because of kind of we're all so busy, we're all doing so much, you know. But I do feel kind of, you know, and it's important to say, I suppose, particularly for parents, there's no one person or no one thing can cause an eating disorder. There's multifactorial kind of, you know, things going on. So we have to be careful, because I know for me, when I have parents coming in with young people and they're kind of, oh, is it something I said, something I didn't say, something I did, something I didn't do? And it's so important that there's no one cause and no one thing. We have what we call predisposing factors that kind of create a vulnerability in an individual to go on to develop an eating disorder.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Leah Sharabu is a Nigerian schoolgirl who was kidnapped along with 110 other students from their girls' boarding school in Dapchi City in the northeast of the country. A month later, most of the surviving girls were released, but not Leah. John Newton of Aid to the Church in Need told Ronan why.
When the moment came to release the girls, the people who kidnapped them, one of the Boko Haram groups, asked anyone that wasn't a Muslim to raise their hand in the air. And as we understand it, at that moment, Leah raised her hand, and the girls with her said, no, keep your hand down, keep your hand down. If they think you're a Muslim, they'll let you go. But she said, no, I am a Christian. And she put her hand up. And because of this, she was separated out from the rest of the girls. The rest of the girls that were still alive were released. But because of her act declaring her faith in our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ, the terrorists kept her, and she continues to be held a hostage to this day. And worryingly, after she was taken, the group actually released a statement back in October 2018 saying that she would be a slave for life and that it was now lawful for them to do whatever they wanted to with her.
My goodness. So has there been any recent report on Leah?
Yes. Only at the end of, at the end of last year, a member of a team working in the country, a humanitarian team, was kidnapped, and she was released earlier this month, and she reported that she had seen Leah Sharabu alive.
Okay, so we know she's alive at least.
We know she's alive. You know, evidence as from this month says she's still alive and well.
Okay, now, as I said to the listeners earlier on, you recently spoke to Leah's mother.
An absolute blessing, yes. Rebecca Sharabu has been in London trying to raise awareness of her daughter's case. Last week, of course, marks the two-year anniversary. There was a big event in Parliament last week when she tried to get more traction on getting her daughter released. She's had various private meetings, and I was very blessed to be able to meet with her yesterday morning.
And is she in incredible distress? Is she managing things well for herself? How is she?
She's an absolutely incredible lady. Obviously, she's been very affected by her daughter's abduction. She was very quiet throughout the time that I met with her. A lot of the time, she was just looking down with her head bowed, almost as though the weight of grief was pressing down upon her. And when she did speak to us through the gene interpreter that she had with her, she said that she was here to cry the tears that Leah wasn't able to cry. And so she very much sees herself as drawing attention, being a voice for her daughter, who, being a captive, can't speak for herself, can't express her plight.
And John, would she be aware that people like ourselves have been praying for her around the world?
Absolutely. I mean, what I actually said to her in response to her very touching and moving message that she said, asking us to keep remembering Leah, to keep praying for Leah, to keep doing all we could to ensure that she was released. I pointed out that here at Aid to the Church in Need in our UK office, we pray the Angelus every day at 12 o'clock. And amongst those that we remember are those who are being held by extremist organisations. There's a number of people being held that we remember. And all those being held by Boko Haram are among those that we pray for.
Wow. And I'm sure that is incredibly encouraging for her, because the worst thing in these kind of situations is you feel like I'm on my own and nobody knows about this, whereas this has really become a massive worldwide story now, I guess.
Absolutely. Although I think there is concern that whereas with the Chibok girls, there was a great head of steam to get something done. There were social media campaigns. There were major politicians speaking out. You know, Michelle Obama, you know, was well known for doing the tweet for Bring Back Our Girls.
Yes,
we haven't seen that same sort of response in Leah's case. We haven't seen that same determination by the international community to get her released. And that there was that concern that, you know, not only Leah, but so many girls are still being held by Boko Haram. That you know, there isn't that enthusiasm, that push, that determination, that drive just to get these girls back.
It's interesting. There seems to be a real hatred of women at the heart of, you know, this Islamist thing, isn't there? Because they that seems to be the thing they go for, to go and, like, they, again, like the Chibok story, where they just go into a school, take a load of girls out. Didn't do the same with guys, you know?
Although, having said that, there have been examples that we know of where Boko Haram has kidnapped men and forced them to serve as soldiers.
Oh, I see. So child soldiers. I get the difference there. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, very good.
You're quite right. In many cases, they kill the men, but they will kidnap the women and they will try and force the women into slavery, into becoming wives for the fighters. They sort of feel that, you know, the men might put up a bit of resistance, so if they feel they can mold them to their cause, they conscript them. If they feel they can't do anything with them, they kill them. But they think that the women will be malleable and flexible. But in the case of, you know, people like Leah, you know, these women, these girls are showing incredible courage in standing up to their abductors. And indeed, we know cases of other women who have been abducted and have refused to marry, who have refused to have relationships with their so-called husbands,
yeah,
and have been punished accordingly. So there's a great strength in these Nigerian women, in many of them which have been kidnapped.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Wouldn't we all like to get away to the sun at this time of year? Ronan talked to travel expert Joe Supple, who told him it's not a great year for last-minute deals, but he still managed to arrange a good deal for Gran Canaria in the Canary Islands, and along the way he shared some great tips for travel.
It's interesting, for once I'm always recommending to people, you know, that last minute book, that last minute deal, last minute trip, and it's they're not good this year.
Really?
Yeah, because you're depending on, like, sort of, you know, Ryanair, Aer Lingus, or maybe the TUI for a charter.
Yeah.
And they're only chartering into, like, Gran Canaria. They're not doing the Lanzarote, stuff like that.
Right.
And also with the demise of Thomas Cook last year, yeah, they wouldn't have done a lot of charters in the winter sun. So
and that
just
was
not
massive.
There.
And
huge.
So, and you know, do you think you're trying to kind of almost replace a large country? You know, it's a huge, huge number of people on the go that Thomas Cook used to deal with, and I presume there were soakage and some companies took you know, some of the overflow, but I mean, where do everybody else go?
Well, that's the thing, you know, as I said, with the winter sun, I mean, like, you would normally have those last minute deals, but even now for the operators, you know, I'd often talk to you about package holiday companies where you look, you book, you basically get your flights, you get your transfers, you get everything. They're using either Aer Lingus or Ryanair, so it's going to be costly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like they have flights there, seats in the charter where they can do the 299s, 399s.
So really what you're telling me, Joe, is prepare.
Prepare, and it's going to be expensive. That's the thing, and you really need to pick your destination quite good. Now, I had a little look. Wasn't really working out too well for me, but then I sort of, you know, with flights and whatever, and I left it so, like, sort of late to book this. But I actually ended up getting on the TUI have a flight that was running down there, which are really good. They would have been the old Falcon originally, and they're very good operators. So it was my first time actually to fly with TUI. Really good service, really nice staff. It's just very comfortable, very nice, whatever. It worked out quite good. And then I was looking at accommodation down there, and again, I suppose because so many places are quite restricted now where people can actually go to. You have a huge amount of the Germans will be going there, the English holidaymakers. So again, availability with hotels, what you were looking for. Now, there's a brand called The Rieu, and you know, it's, people say to me, you know, we've got brands here like, you know, the Intercontinental, like the Westin, and when you know a brand, you know it's going to be good.
Sure.
I'd looked at the package thing, and it was a hotel I wasn't very familiar with, so I thought, oh, I'll just try The Rieu. So The Rio Grande Palace, which is a five-star, they've actually about four or five. They're a really big brand. They've hotels all over the world. It's a Spanish brand. But I checked out their hotel, which is the Rio Grande Canaria.
Okay.
Now, be careful when you're booking something. Somebody, a friend asked me recently, what's the name of that one again? I said, look, there's about seven hotels. Make sure you get the right one.
This is
a four-star all-inclusive. So basically, for people who have not stayed in all-inclusive before, it means everything is included. Your drinks, your food, breakfast, lunch, snacks, dinners, everything's included. And of course, you're going to have a great entertainment package there as well. You know,
sure.
In the evening, they've got singers on, they have a show they put on every night, you know, yeah. Anything from Greece, all the
crew. So in a way, if you're a person who likes to go on holidays and stay put, this is perfect for you.
Absolutely perfect, yeah. Because, you know, you can go off, you're right in the promenade, you're right in the beach area, but they've got so many different elements to it. And again, for people who haven't been there before to Gran Canaria, it's about approximately about a four-hour flight.
Okay.
At the transfer down to, I stayed in Mas Palomas, so you got Mas Palomas, Melanares, so basically from, you fly into Las Palmas, and then you've got like Playa de Ingles, and you've got Mas Palomas, Melanares, and of course, really popular with the Irish tourists is that Puerto Rico is a really popular place for people to stay, and also there's another beautiful place called Mogán, which is like a fishing village, really, really nice property.
Mogán,
very, very nice. I've been there before for day visits. As I said, with Mas Palomas is really good, but also on the resort, I noticed it really, really, really good for if you have family with kids and stuff, they're looked after. I was watching, you know, like you've got the adult areas where, you know, adult only, but also you've got great kids slides, water slides there.
Gotcha.
It's very secure. But then also with the entertainment team, they bring them over, so they're playing baseball in the afternoon, they're playing tennis, stuff like that. Yeah, so they're kept busy all the time, the kids. And then the adults can have their little bit of time.
Yeah, which is, you know, you kill for that now when you've got kids that age.
That's it. And you know yourself, kids are looking for ice creams, drinks. That's all included. Yeah. Everything is included.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
Cork native Edith Wilkins is the founder of the Edith Wilkins Street Children Foundation, which works to rehabilitate street children in northern India, some of whom have been through unimaginable hardships and trauma. Her love affair with India started four decades ago when she first qualified as a nurse. Here she explains how her first visit to India came about.
All nurses kind of say, yeah, I'd love to travel, but no, this was like 40 years ago nearly.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
I know, yeah.
You were unusual enough in that time.
It was very unusual for it to go. But anyway, you know what the strangest thing was? I actually went to a prayer meeting with friends of mine in UCC.
Wow.
And I kind of said, no, it's kind of a strange one because I actually didn't belong to a group or anything, but friends of mine belonged to this group. And I said, okay, so we went off to the prayer meeting in UCC. And I said, right. I said, if this is supposed to happen, your man would phone me. So actually, John O'Shea phoned me on the Monday because I actually started with goal.
Gosh.
And I said, yeah, and within a few weeks, I was in India. We only went for 3 months. 3 months, and I came home 3 years later.
Gosh. So you initially went on a stint for kind of 90 days, and you think, we'll see how this goes. And actually, what happened that made you stay for 3 years then?
I fell in love. I fell in love with the children. I fell in love with people. And I suppose part of me was just, initially when I was working there, I was working out in the villages, out in the middle of nowhere. You wouldn't see another right person. You know, people didn't speak English. I had to learn Bengali fairly quickly. But children dying from simple things like, you know, measles, whooping cough, all the things that we have a vaccination here against. So I just fell in love with the place, and it was just very spiritual. It just stole my heart totally.
Gosh,
that's
wonderful.
And that was it. Ended up staying there for 3 years, came home 3 years later, and about 3 stone later. So,
I was just about to say, a lot of people I speak to who end up, you know, in that kind, particularly when they get very connected with the place, they do lose weight, they do have a kind of a culture shock coming back as well.
Oh, you do. And you can very much, you know, I think this time, the last time I came home, which was only a few years ago, when I came home for good, I definitely had kind of, not a post-traumatic stress, but it was very much, you know, the whole culture, getting used to living here again, everything.
Yeah.
We actually went back out to India. I went back out in the summer. Somebody sponsored a trip out for myself, and my daughter came with me, and went back out in the summer, and it was the strangest experience. I literally walked in as if I had been there yesterday. There was no transition.
Just picked up where you left off, basically. Yeah,
and when I came back to Ireland, I got this big wham.
Yeah.
God, I'm back in Ireland. So it was, it works the other way around. But then I spent more than half my life over there. So.
Of course you did. I'm sure there was grieving even having, like when you say leaving for good, as it were, I'm sure it's not ever, it's never going to be for good, right? Because you will go back, I'm sure. But in terms of your life, your location is very much now here. And that must have been taking some transition coming back too.
It took some transition run. But you know what? I had two kids. I actually adopted two Indian children. I have two children, Krishma and Omer. They're grown up now. But, I suppose a lot of it was settling them into school, getting time to spend with the family, and then trying to set up the foundation here and stick to our ethos of voluntary, no salaries, this kind of a thing.
Sure,
so,
it
took up a lot of the time.
Can I ask you how did the foundation come about?
I was back in Ireland with my two kids, getting their residency and getting their citizenship here. I had to come back and live here for a year because I was considered a foreigner. And this group that we had in Calcutta rang me and said, look, we had set up what we call a group, just a general support group, I suppose, for all the NGOs working together there. And the forum rang me and they said, would you think about going to North India? Because there's groups up there working with street kids, they haven't a clue, there's huge child trafficking, and would you consider going up there, and bringing your organisation up there? So we set up the Edith Wilkins Street Children Trust, our foundation, and that was in 2003.
Yeah.
So back to Calcutta, and back up then north to Darjeeling, to the borders where the children were being trafficked and bought and sold across the border.
So what kind of work did the foundation initially focus on?
I suppose running it was kind of a learning game for all of us, because it was the first time something like this had been done. We were the first halfway house, as we say, in India, when we actually set up these programs. But what happened basically was that we discovered when we went to organisations and people who had orphanages as such for children, nobody would take our children because, God love them, at 6, 7, 8 years of age, they had things like gonorrhea, syphilis, they had been totally traumatised after being raped and, brutalised. And a lot of groups wouldn't take the children from us. So we set up what we call halfway houses where the kids can be transitioned, they can be counselled, they can, be kind of rehabilitated, and then they can go into the education system. They can, get in, just giving them back their childhood.
The Best of the Morning Show.
We really appreciated the honesty of our prayer coach this week, Gary McDowell, minister at Greystones Presbyterian Church in County Wicklow. As it was Ash Wednesday, we asked Gary to talk about the connection between fasting and prayer. He was quick to say he was no expert, but then he shared some great insights that I think anyone would find helpful.
As I say, I'm no expert in this realm, and it's not really a huge part of the tradition that I come from.
But it's
something that is it's raised up to myself over the years, You think, because this was such an important part of the biblical narrative. As you read the Old Testament and the New Testament, and it's there. It's just there. It's like giving. It's like praying. It's just a part of what people who loved God did.
Yeah.
And certainly all the great people of the Bible, Moses, David, Elijah, Anna, Esther, Jesus, Paul, they all fasted. And so I'm challenged by that. I've tried fasting from food over the years, on and off, but not on a regular kind of thing. And as Steve mentioned to me in the last couple of days, and just about thinking about that, it has made me rethink about that. And I've done some reading about it as well. Think about the gap that is in my life personally, and the things that I'm missing out on. Just as I've read, and it's stuff that I know, but just about the great enrichment there is in a spiritual level, because that's what it's about. It's about giving up something in order to focus on God, become more intimate with God.
Sure,
and that's what I really want for my life personally and for us as a church, and so it's something to be taken seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, actually, now that you mention it, one of the things that occurred to me was, the way, actually, a lot of the time we are very dependent on the Lord, and a lot of our life is spent trying to convince ourselves that we're not. Do you know what I mean? That we actually are. And it's kind of a fallacy, a kind of a lie that we create for ourselves. And sometimes I think that the idea of depriving yourself of something really puts you in touch with your own vulnerability, your own feeling of not, you know, of powerlessness in some ways. Like, I feel like my big thing is sugar, okay? When I decide, like, and I'll be fasting from sugar this way, not just sugar in things, but just generally sugar. And within about a day and a half, I'm really feeling fairly low. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, so either I can start feeling really low and down and depressed, or I can get on my face and go, actually, I need you, Lord.
Mm-hmm.
It gets me in touch with that feeling of my age, Lord, you know?
Yeah. I think that's probably what it's meant to do. It's meant to expose the things that we rely on. What do we really like? We live in an age of fast food, not fasting from food.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and it's all so easy.
Yeah.
And it's all so available. And that's just the kind of culture we are. Wouldn't have been like that, of course, in Jesus' day. But that's the culture we live in. So the thought of fasting from any item seems like a crazy thing to do.
Yeah.
And yet it is obviously a good thing to do because it does expose what you rely upon. And I mean, Jesus started his ministry, those 40 days of fasting.
Yeah.
And that was at the start of something really important. And when Satan came along and said to him, you must be really hungry, turn those stones to bread.
Yeah,
and he said, remember that great line, but people can't live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God. So it's just not a matter of fasting from something. It is turning to him because it's all about him ultimately. We want to be drawn close to him and become like him in so many ways.
And is that the thing that, I suppose, separates, you know, being on a diet from being on a fast?
Yeah. Yes, it's nothing to do with vanity, not to try and look at the waistline, because you could all do with losing a few pounds. And actually, it's probably one of the side benefits of it. But no, it's not about vanity. It's very much not about yourself. It is about God. And it's a private arrangement between you and God. And that's why Jesus, when he was talking to his disciples, he said, whenever you fast, because they could see the Pharisees, the holy people, fasting. And everybody knew they were fasting, you know, and it was, they were so proud of how often they fasted.
I'm fasting better than you.
That's right. How godly they were. But Jesus said, no, don't you be like that. You know, you wash your face, you look bright and cheerful. So people don't know because it's between you and God. If everybody says, oh, Ronan's very spiritual, he's on a fast today. Well, you've got your reward already, he says.
There you go.
But if they don't know, if it's between you and God, your reward lies in heaven.
Yeah.
The great thing is that God always rewards those who seek him, and that's what fasting is about. It's another way of turning towards him, saying, all this other stuff, I'm leaving for a while, and I'm turning towards you, and he rewards that.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Paul Harrington has had an outstanding music career, including, of course, winning the Eurovision Song Contest in 1994, along with his friend Charlie McGettigan and their great song, Rock and Roll Kids. Paul was in the studio this week and he shared some unexpected career highlights with Ronan.
It's always hard to think about, you know, the outstanding moments, you know. I mean, this is going to sound very strange, but I suppose when you do, you know, I remember the very first television thing I did, I was still working in the civil service and I was live at 3, and at that time you used to go out and pre-record your song in the morning and then they would broadcast in the afternoon.
Absolutely.
So I wound up going back to work in the Department of Labour on Mespel Road, which is now a hotel, and there was a TV in the library section. So there was a lot of us, a gang of us went in to watch me singing a song called Up on the Roof.
That's such a buzz, though.
You know, and I said, oh, my God, or hearing your record. I mean, my very first record was 1988. I did a cover
of That's right, of Tempo Woman, I remember it well.
And to hear that on the radio, and to hear it going into the I had no clue about purchase squads or how to get a record into the charts, which is all you know how that works.
Sure.
We all know how it works.
None of us did then, though.
No. I mean, we weren't aware at the time that Albert Reynolds was paying people to queue up outside dance halls, you know, to exactly. when Dickie Rock and those would be playing. You know, so everything is hyperbole. Those were the wonderful thrills. But something I did do, which was a very strange, odd thing to do, but I used to, when I worked in the civil service, I used to drive this yellow Ford Cortina with green seats.
He wasn't drawing attention to himself at all.
At all, yeah. And you know, all I was short of was wearing a sombrero while driving. But I used to drive past the bottom of Grafton Street going to work. At the time, this is when no traffic restrictions there. And I would often, every year, I would listen and hear the Gay Byrne show from Bewley's, And so anyway, this particular year, probably the year after myself and Charlie won it, the Christmas of that year, we were invited to take part and be on the show. And, you know, I kind of relived that.
I
kind of drove by it, listening to it.
Yeah.
And I parked up. And I walked in among the crowd, and Joe Duffy was outside.
Yeah.
And I was able to, it was like stepping through a silver screen.
Absolutely.
And I stepped into it, and upstairs there was a fire blazing. Everyone was having breakfast. Gay was there, all the production people, and it was absolutely magical. It was like just stepping into
Wonderland. Yeah.
It was like that. You know that moment where in The Wizard of Oz where they go from black and white to color.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it was.
Yeah.
Like.
Beautiful, beautiful. And it's funny how all of those things are kind of almost like younger references, little cultural references you had from being younger and being in the place and suddenly going, you know, I've been the person listening to this and now I'm the person doing it.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's magic, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, when you got to do, I remember, you know, when the first time I got to sing on a jingle, on a radio ad, you know, and this was the practice then, they had the voiceover artist there, you know, and it was Bill Golding. And I stood talking to him. He spoke to me, right? And it was like my whole body rattled.
Right,
like there was a radio in front of me.
Right, yeah.
I said, what is this voice? My God. It was like God spoke.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I remember him because he was Rory in Wanderley Wagon.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm of that age. He was like, and I couldn't believe it. Like I was a fully grown adult.
I
met Rory from Wanderley Wagon. And everyone's going, what? Well, from what?
I know. I mean, it's incredible.
It's,
you know, it's lovely that it puts a smile on our faces today.
You did the restaurant.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
What
I did.
Was that like?
Absolutely brilliant. And particularly if you like food, you know, and I love to cook.
Yeah.
So, as I say, there's one thing I like more than cooking is eating. And it was terrific. I would, if it was something like you could recommend like a boot camp, like, you know, the way in some countries that you have to do a certain amount of national service and stuff like that. This, for me, would be absolutely, you should spend a day in a professional restaurant.
Absolutely.
With a professional. But of course, now, it's for telly, don't forget. So they're very good with you. But it's a long day. You're pretty exhausted at the end of it.
You're wasted.
And
are you really, I suppose you're on edge because you're trying to see at the very end of the very long day, you're there trying to see how did this go.
Absolutely.
How was it received?
You know, you're going out to be judged by you know, these three Michelin star Marco Pierre White, Rachel Allen, and my guest judge at the time was, his name is Joe, is Joe O'Shea? Anyway, he has a great place in Cork. Forgive me for forgetting for this moment. I didn't prepare for that, but what a great day. And you know, obviously you do, as they say to you, you can cook as much as you want or as little as you want.
Yeah.
But you know, at the end of the day, you've got a huge, brilliant team there, Gary Hanlon and Louise and Steve McAllister,
well,
all these guys who are brilliant. And they execute your menu, you know, which is amazing. But that was a great day. And of course, and to get 5 stars in the end, well, you don't expect.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.